The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So, Jackie, you've got a recent article in the Globe and Mail on natural gas. Really well done. What's it about?
Well, it's about why natural gas can become a low-carbon fuel of the future. And, you know, I started looking into this several months ago and actually was kind of interested in it because of a podcast I heard with Tyler Brandt from FortisBC in terms of, you know, how much energy we get from natural gas to heat our homes and the challenges with electrifying that. And so I make the case that, you know, when you really consider how hard it is to switch off natural gas, especially in cold climates like Canada, we should really be thinking about how we can make our natural gas clean instead of just thinking we're going to electrify everything, which may not be that practical to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's a monumental task to go switching out all the appliances that we use that use natural gas. Certainly dominantly, number one, the furnace in most people's homes, certainly in Western Canada, where we would freeze to death if we didn't have it. Then there's the water heater, typically. And then on top of that, there's stoves and ovens and who
barbecues,
knows what.
Barbecue. Yep.
You know, it goes on and on. So, but, you know, the core vital ones are very expensive to swap out. So it's really important to think about these issues in terms of, well, if we're going to decarbonize and hit certain targets by 2030, 40, 50, how natural gas is going to interplay with electrification.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, no, I was excited to write it. So we'll put a link to it in the show notes. That was in the Globe and Mail.
Yeah, that's recently. Great. But we are going to talk about it more. And you already mentioned Tyler Bryant, who's the strategic advisor, climate and energy at FortisBC, one of the big utilities in this country. So I'd like to welcome Tyler to talk about natural gas and such. So welcome.
Thanks a lot, Peter. Thanks a lot, Jackie. Very happy to be here to have this conversation with you.
Okay, well, let's start by just telling us a bit about FortisBC and your business.
So FortisBC is a subsidiary of Fortis Inc., which is a large utility holding company across North America. So they own, I believe, 12 utilities in North America, 10 or 12. And FortisBC is one of the largest components of that. And we're a regulated gas and electric utility. We have about 1.2 million customers or meters across the province, have about 2,500 employees. And in fact, as we're primarily a gas utility, so it's about 90-10 gas to electric. And by virtue of that, we deliver more energy to British Columbians than any other entity, really. So big part of BC's energy system. And we've been putting a lot of time and effort and thinking to this challenge of decarbonization and what, in fact, the role of the gas utility, or of a combined utility, rather, could be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you think a lot about that because you are, as your title said, the strategic advisor on climate and energy. And you've held a number of positions, including at the IEA, David Suzuki Foundation, Natural Resources Canada, the federal government. Tell us why you decided to join FortisBC.
Yeah, great question. I've been somewhat of a, or completely a policy wonk my entire professional life. And joining a large company like Fortis with the impetus, with the imperative to take action on climate change was really attractive. It was kind of policymaking in practice, so to speak, or applied policymaking. So that was really good to kind of move from government, move from, you know, international organization, NGO, what have you, do a lot of thinking, do a lot of talking, do a lot of proposing and ideas, stone throwing, what have you. But to actually be kind of on the sharp edge of the spear at a large organization like Fortis is really attractive. It was really interesting. You know, we can put resources behind this. We can make the decisions to decarbonize. And it's really, at the end of the day, it'll be largely driven by large organizations like Fortis, large companies, to really take the reins here and make those low-carbon investments.
All right. Well, let's start with some of the challenges of electrifying heating buildings and industrial. Maybe you can just tell us, like, why is it so difficult? You know, a lot of people just say, hey, we're going to electrify everything. Let's get rid of the natural gas and everyone's going to get heat pumps. Why is that a challenge?
It's a very large challenge along a number of different vectors. I think it all kind of traces back, though, Jackie, to the fact that heating is just such an immense energy end use. It is the largest energy end use for basically anything we consume energy for. Globally, over half the energy we consume is for heat. In BC, it's about 45% of all the energy we consume is for heat. You know, that's far and away the largest end use for energy. So just right there, we have a huge challenge. We just have this giant lump of energy demand that we need to decarbonize. The other issue with heating is that it's incredibly peaky when it hits. It's not like, say, lighting, for example, in the electricity system. You know, we have basically lighting needs. It fluctuates as we have less or more daylight hours. But, you know, it's kind of constant throughout the year. Whereas in the gas system at FortisBC, we deliver over 50% of all the energy we deliver is delivered in less than 30% of the days of the year. It's this really compressed. Obviously, you only need heat when you need it, when it gets cold. And so the gas system has been designed both operationally and financially through its business model to basically deliver that heat over kind of short interspersed periods. And so if we're going to electrify it, we're going to have a big challenge to build out an electricity system that's capable of meeting these peaks. Mm-hmm. And then we don't know what we're going to do with that capacity on the shoulders of those cold seasons. And so that's really the issue. And then the other kind of really critical factor to take account of here is just resiliency. You know, this is people's heat. As Peter, you just mentioned, like, people would freeze to death. It's not good enough, frankly, to not deliver heat. Your system needs to be built to deliver that heat when you absolutely need it. And so that's the utility perspective, for example, is that it's got to be strong. It's got to be resilient. And so an electricity system that's delivering that heat would need to be quite large, quite robust in order to kind of meet that energy end use.
And I used a few numbers in the article that actually came from a study that Fortis had commissioned, which were just amazing to me, that in the summer, the demand for natural gas is something like the equivalent, if you put it in electricity terms, 3 gigawatt. And on the coldest day of winter, and was 18 gigawatts. And I think you've had a colder day even since then. So just a huge amount of electrical capacity would have to be built to meet the difference between summer and that very cold winter day. Mm-hmm. And just to put it in perspective, I think you'd said something like that BC Hydro's entire hydro capacity is 50% smaller than that peak.
That's right. So we had a peak event here December 27th of 2021. At that peak hour of 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. when people wake up, turn on their furnaces or their heating equipment, FortisBC was delivering, or BC's gas system was delivering about 20,000 megawatts equivalent. And the provincial electricity system, BC Hydro's, is about 10, 11,000. So just heat, so that's just the heat basically, is double the size of BC Hydro's capacity.
Right. So actually, as an Albertan grown up on natural gas, and that's just sort of the paradigm that we're accustomed to, looking over the border at BC where you're dominantly powered by hydroelectric, I was under the impression that there already was a lot of, say, electric baseboard heating and all that kind of stuff. But what you're telling me is that a lot of the heat still comes from natural gas, even in BC where there's so much hydroelectric.
That's right. So BC, relatively speaking, has a fairly large share of electric heat. So about 35% of all, you know, space heating is met with electricity. Mm-hmm. That's in residential buildings. Over 50% is met with natural gas. And in the commercial sector, so commercial buildings, institutional buildings, you know, it's over 80% is met with natural gas. So that's the thing, is the electricity system has been built to allow some amount of electrified heating. And now we have the challenge of, if you want to electrify that heating beyond that, you're going to need to very quickly consider new capacity resources to meet that. And if we care about climate change, that capacity needs to be clean. And so you really narrow down the options you have and you increase the costs in order to do that.
Well, I mean, and, you know, further to what Jackie was saying, like the 18 versus the 3 gigawatts, a 6-to-1 dynamic range in power from season to season means basically you've really got to lay a lot more copper to be able to handle all that, right, to the individual buildings and houses and so on. And I mean, that's just a monumental expense.
Well, and the other thing too is, you know, it's, you talk about that peak happening at 7 a.m. Well, you're not going to have solar then. You're on a very cold day, you're generally not going to have wind. So how are you going to meet that electrical demand in a clean way? I think that's another question that I had when I looked at it.
Well, that's the thing. And if you want to say what the killer app, you know, quote unquote, of the gas system is its ability to store energy. I mean, it's basically built to store energy. It's built to store energy daily and even seasonally. So FortisBC's transmission pipelines, for example, can store about the equivalent of 40 gigawatt hours just in what we call line pack. So we could just pack the pipelines full of gas. But there's also large storage reserves across the province in the United States and Alberta that can store, you know, monumental amounts of gas. Like half of your annual consumption of gas can be stored at a facility that Fortis Holdings owns at Aitken Creek. And it's very cheap to do that. So about a dollar per gigajoule to store that energy. Conversely, to store that amount of energy in a battery, an electric battery, is about $80 per gigajoule. So it's orders and orders of magnitude more expensive. And we can expect those battery costs to decrease. Of course they will. But there's just such a huge gap between that's the cost of storage between those two systems that it's likely not going to be made up.
Now, some people are skeptical about this whole we need gas forever. I found that with my article. I had a lot of positive feedback, but some negative as well, because people want to electrify everything and think that's the clean way to go. But one of the objections was, you know, electric heat pumps are very efficient. Apparently, they're three times more efficient than a high-efficiency natural gas furnace under the right conditions. So have you factored that in? Like, yeah, that peak that we were talking about, it's high, but, you know, when you consider how efficient these heat pumps are, that's going to make up some of that. You won't need to get quite so high in that peak because of that.
No, that is a really great point. It is a bit unfair to say 20,000 megawatts to 10, because that's assuming that we would just all go to, say, electric resistance baseboard heaters, and that wouldn't happen, right? Like, we would use those high efficiency electric heat pumps. But still, we're talking about 20,000 megawatts. So even if you were using the most efficient cold climate heat pumps, you may be able to cut that down by a factor of three. But you're still talking about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 megawatts of additional capacity you would need. And then you add on top of that all these other stresses that we need clean electricity for, such as in the transportation sector with electric vehicles, or clean electricity for some industrial applications, so on and so forth. So that gets back to my original point. The immensity of heat, the size of that energy demand is just so large that even with electric heat pumps, which we will, you know, need to some capacity, just won't be enough to address that problem.
I mean, there is a lot of calculation and effort going into being able to generate that amount of upstream capacity, the gigawatts of energy required. But to me, the big issue is in the transmission and distribution of that capacity right to the curb of your home, right? Into the basement of your home, into your utility box. That, to me, that's where the big issue is. And then expecting that the consumer is going to retire their existing appliances, call in somebody to come and redo their electrical system, so on and so forth. I mean, it just seems like a monumental task.
Decarbonizing to the scale that we will need to 2050 is going to be an absolutely immense task. But I completely agree with you, Peter, that we don't really know what the bottleneck is to electrify everything. I think you're right. I think actually we could potentially look out and say, you know, there could be a maximalist solar and wind future for the electricity system, but it gets down to the bottlenecks of how are we going to transmit and distribute that energy. And we've seen like major issues in kind of dense urban centers of, say, tripling your distribution capacity. That's a huge job. That's why, you know, when you think about role of the gas system, you go, geez, like drop in fuels, drop in low carbon fuels could look kind of attractive, you know, like they involve a lot fewer decision points. It's big utilities and energy producers, energy developers, and you can put that in the existing infrastructure. It's kind of repurposing an existing system rather than building a whole new one. I think like that really frames up what this challenge is and what the trade-off is between, say, using the gas system with low carbon gases versus mothballing it and choosing to rebuild your electricity system one time over.
Yeah. And one of the points in my article was talking about the circular economy and how to reuse things. Why don't we figure out a way to reuse this infrastructure that already goes up to the homes and works? And we already have, you know, all that infrastructure built. How can it become low carbon? Because I think that's important. A lot of people object to using natural gas because they think it's going to stay the same way. But there's a way to make it clean. I want to talk about that. But before we get to that, I want to ask you, recently I've been seeing more information about natural gas not being healthy in your home and that it has health risks, so concerns that kids are getting asthma from using gas stoves and burners. Do you think there's a concern there, and are there ways to mitigate that?
So there's a lot of research coming out on this, and we're monitoring this closely. I mean, what we perceive is going on is that cooking on any stove produces indoor air emissions, and that the most effective way to address that, no matter kind of what cooktop that you're using is to use a range hood and really improve that ventilation, disperse the particulate matter, volatile organic compounds, that type of thing. The nice thing is that new BC building codes will, at least in BC, will, you know, require that type of ventilation and so on and so forth. But by my read, like, the really key solution there is not necessarily swapping out different fuel sources, but improving ventilation in indoor spaces.
And for your furnace and your water heater, like down in your utility room, are those vented already? Like, you don't have that concern there?
Yeah, you should go through a roof or a sidewall vent outdoors.
Renewable natural gas, that's getting a lot of buzz too. So this is gas that comes from municipal waste and other places where we can tap into methane that is not extracted from deep underground, but is produced on the surface by various natural means. So what about that?
Renewable gas is really the skeleton key here to unlocking the potential of the gas system to align with our low carbon future. I mean, that's needed. I'm really talking about the gas system, that system of pipes, of infrastructure that we use to deliver gas as an energy carrier. And gas has really important qualities, attributes that make it desirable to, say, use for heating because it could be stored easily. But it needs to be low carbon or even no carbon, right? And that's why we need to transition or flip the gas system over to providing majority of renewable or low carbon fuels, whereas today we're providing, you know, natural gas, which has a higher carbon intensity. So FortisBC has been basically the leader on the continent in terms of developing its renewable natural gas program. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary, actually, of opening that voluntary program. So how that works is any one of our customers can go onto our website and basically sign up for a blend of renewable natural gas. And Peter, you're right. Right now, renewable natural gas largely comes from biogenic waste, municipal solid waste, wastewater treatment plants, agricultural waste, that type of thing. You throw it in an oxygen-starved environment and you get methane coming out, and we can inject that into the pipeline. It's basically interchangeable from natural gas, from methane we pull out of the ground, except that it's part of the natural carbon cycle here on the Earth. So it's not adding net carbon to the atmosphere.
Right. But the reality check here is that as a fraction of total amount of methane consumed, the stuff that is biogenically generated above ground is a small fraction of what we get from below ground.
That is absolutely the rub. Up until recently, like, the thinking has been there has not been enough renewable natural gas in order to completely displace natural gas consumption in the gas system. However, we've been working quite hard. I mean, the entire industry of gas utilities around the world have been really looking into this. And it appears as though there could be a lot more renewable gas, renewable natural gas, and hydrogen, which we can talk about a bit later, than we originally thought. In fact, significantly so. I don't want to pull the lid off the pot here, but we've just in the process of completing a supply potential study for BC of renewable gases. And we'll see, we're going to release this very shortly within the next 2 or 3 weeks, that the resource potential of this renewable gas is much, much larger than we had originally thought. And why is that? Well, new technologies are coming to the fore. We could use what's called a gasification process. So instead of relying on carbon-rich fuels like waste and that type of stuff, we can move to stuff like woody biomass, for example, biomass waste. And BC has quite a large forestry sector that produces a lot of biomass waste. Well, that could be used for renewable natural gas with new technology, kind of a generation two of that technology. And we're advancing a number of projects. And then, of course, using hydrogen as well in the gas system as a gas that's produced from low carbon sources. We think actually we could be on the cusp of some very meaningful change in terms of how much renewable gas we can get into our system.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. We'll talk about hydrogen here in a second, but I find that the challenge is it's still combustion, right? And we're still adding CO2 and loading up the atmosphere, whether it comes from below ground or above ground. And I know above ground, it's supposed to be circular and so on, but if you're adding the CO2 at a rate that we're adding it at, you know, it gets to be a little bit moot. So I guess that's just sort of amusing and a commentary by me, which sort of does lead us to the hydrogen conversation. And especially, say, if it's blue hydrogen, you've got the CCS carbon capture, which takes the carbon and puts it back into the ground. So tell us about what you're doing with the hydrogen side of things.
Yeah, so if I was to divine or peer forward well into the future, the 2050 net zero future, I think you would see that hydrogen would become the dominant energy carrier for the gas system. We can spend an entire podcast talking about just this one topic, but just to say that hydrogen really is not necessarily feedstock constrained at all. You can use renewable power. So for every cent per kilowatt hour that solar or wind drops, that makes the business case for hydrogen again that much better. You can also use, as you're saying, Peter, really low-cost natural gas reserves, such as in BC, Alberta, and the Montney Basin. It's actually quite low carbon as well, like relatively speaking to other natural gas basins in the continent. And you can use what looks to be really promising technology, like autothermal reforming, CCS, CCUS, that can really achieve quite a significant carbon intensity reduction. And then you flow that through the pipeline system. Now, the pipeline system will need modifications. It may need upgrades, improvements, additions to take that hydrogen into the system. But by that point, yes, you're combusting hydrogen. You're not adding any carbon to the atmosphere at all. And you really are kind of leveraging both. You're really integrating at that point the gas and electric systems to producing those energy carriers that you need for their kind of most optimized end use.
Hey, I just want to ask, you know, Peter talked about the renewable natural gas still creates CO2, which is true. However, if you hadn't captured that, it would have put a lot of methane into the atmosphere, which is a more potent greenhouse gas. So it is still net basis, really positive for the greenhouse gas emissions problem. Is that right?
Exactly. And while you still are adding carbon, there is a fairly quick turnaround carbon cycle on the Earth. And, you know, I would much rather be introducing a carbon molecule that was part of that carbon cycle than that one that's been sequestered kilometers underground, say, in BC's gas basins.
Right.
So, you know, while that's the case, you know, and you can also really make some substantial benefits from capturing that methane that would have, as you're saying, Jackie, otherwise just emitted itself to the atmosphere. You know, it could be anywhere from 25 to 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas.
To wrap up this section, I know there's lots of numbers out there for renewable natural gas and hydrogen, but in general, if you could blend as much renewable natural gas as you think is possible, and maybe that number is going to even get greater, and we'll watch for that study, with as much hydrogen as you think you can blend in today's system, which some people say is up to 20%, how greenhouse gas intense is that fuel that you might be delivering to homes? Would that be a net zero fuel, or is it still a long ways off and you still need to do direct air capture or something else to offset all of the emissions?
Yeah, so great question. So not to get too wonky on your audience here, but it's hard not to when you talk carbon intensity. So hopefully this is the as wonky as we get. But the carbon intensity, as we say, of renewable natural gas, you know, of course, everything, it's all over the map, but it's about 10 grams of carbon per megajoule. And that's about the same carbon intensity of, say, BC Hydro's electricity system right now. So there's different data sets of, you know, there's arguments about this, but they're generally on the same plane as each other. And then depending on what type of feedstock you use for hydrogen, it could be as low as 5 grams per megajoule, zero, or it could go up to, say, 25 or 30 grams per megajoule. Right now, natural gas on a life cycle basis is about 60 grams per megajoule. So you're making a really steep reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And that would be one of the lowest carbon fuels you could consume. There isn't really anything better than that. So addressing a second part of your question there, Jackie, yes, you will still need negative emissions technologies, in my opinion, this is my personal opinion, no matter what, when you're getting on a net zero type of plane, right? You will never be able to fully erase carbon from your energy system. And so we will need some way to pull carbon out after the fact.
So yeah, but what you're saying though is that it's actually possible to get as clean as hydroelectricity, which is pretty clean.
Yeah, well, it's hydroelectricity and a mix of kind of market imports, which is why BC Hydro's carbon intensity is that, because they are purchasing electricity on the market, such as Mid-C in Washington State, but there is some thermal generation that is going into their carbon intensity as well.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of cities, upwards of 100, that have banned natural gas for new homes and buildings, appliances. Canada, a few cities have plans for such bans in the future. So what do you think of that? Is that, you know, further to the conversation we've had about electrical load and so on and so forth? I guess it's latitude dependent in some ways. It depends how extreme your weather is from hot to cold. But what are you thinking on that?
This is a great question. This is a really kind of top of mind emerging issue that's writing itself in real time right now. And there's been different ways that this has been communicated to external audiences through the news and that type of thing. But I can only comment about our experiences here in BC. And we've been working with municipalities, say, like the city of Vancouver, that has announced a very ambitious, a very stringent climate emergency action plan, for example. And their goal is to get to zero carbon for new buildings. And in fact, they've actually opened a pathway for stuff like renewable gas to also be a part of that solution set. So it's not necessarily a ban on the gas system. It's removing natural gas from those new buildings. And that has led FortisBC to, I think, have proposed a world-leading new tariff that we've just filed with our regulator to require that new buildings connected to our system be connected to 100% renewable natural gas tariff. So any new building, if that filing is approved, would be put on a mandatory RNG tariff going forward, which would address, say, the city of Vancouver's goals to have all new buildings become zero carbon.
Can you expand on this notion of an RNG tariff? Can you explain that?
Yes. So we are quite aggressively expanding our supply of renewable natural gas. So in 2020, we tripled the supply of renewable natural gas we had in our portfolio. Then in 2021, we tripled that again. And we're going to more than triple it likely in the next 2 years here. And so how that would work is we would divert that renewable natural gas to new buildings through the tariff. Now, of course, those new buildings wouldn't actually receive those molecules of renewable natural gas. That's not how the gas system works. But of course, that's not how the electric system works either. You know, you don't get renewable electrons delivered if you, say, purchase a renewable electric contract, for example. But through our accounting of our supply portfolio, we could apportion those renewable gas molecules to those new buildings and satisfy the climate policies that we need to with our various municipal stakeholders.
So all things the same, there'd be more renewable natural gas on the system than there would have been otherwise if that new home hadn't been built.
So yeah, we're quite assertively expanding this program, seeing, you know, peering into the near future, that we're going to need to provide a low carbon option to our customers.
Right. So the restaurateurs who want to sizzle their food will have an option. Is that what you're saying?
They can still grill their steaks this time on renewable methane.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, congratulations on the work you've done. I think you're a real leader in renewable natural gas in Canada. And you know, as the federal government is now working very hard on these plans about how the economy is going to decarbonize, I hope that they're considering clean natural gas as one of the solutions to meeting our very aggressive greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals in Canada.
I don't see how they couldn't consider the gas system and clean or renewable gases as part of that net zero future. And in fact, you know, we're doing some preliminary work on net zero futures ourselves, and it's almost that the more you drive to zero, the more important the gas system becomes because of its ability to store energy and its ability to address those quite hard to decarbonize sectors. And so the more you kind of look into it, the more analysis that you kind of place on this really difficult issue, the more it becomes clear that, geez, we begin to think about how we can repurpose this system rather than abandon it.
Mm-hmm. So what percentage of total supply is it, just to give our audience a sense of, you know, how much RNG, renewable natural gas, can be switched over this decade?
Well, by 2025, we anticipate to have over 10% of our throughput to be renewable or low carbon. That's a huge expansion. Just to maybe put that in reference to something, you know, that's approximately the same amount of energy that will be generated by the new Site C dam in BC. And so we're basically adding a Site C's worth of clean energy to our gas system in the next 3 years here.
Great. Great.
Thank you so much, Tyler, for coming on our show. We really enjoyed the conversation, and we'll continue to follow your work and the studies that you referenced that are coming out in the future.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler.
Well, thanks a lot. I had some fun.
Okay, and thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.